there's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. It's always one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, July the 11th, and this is episode 3522 of the Survival Podcast. Given it is a Thursday and we are on regularly scheduled programming this week, that means it is time for an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. With one notable absence, the expert council member, which really is a team, that never, ever doesn't have a segment for me, doesn't have a segment this week, and that would be Dr. Ron Paul and Dan McAdams and Chris Rossini over there at Liberty Report, and you can blame Hurricane Beryl for it. Apparently, Dr. Paul does have a whole house backup generator for his home. But they ain't got diddly all for backup power at their studio where they actually record the show. So they haven't been producing shows this week, so giving us a segment out of the show, but that wasn't going to happen. So I thought the only reason I even tell you all that is because if you are a small company, especially, where you make decisions for your office and your office personnel, you might want to think about having some redundancy, not just at home, but at the office. Just saying. A lot of times people don't because they can work from home if they have to, and they figure it's not likely the power will be out in both locations. Well, when you talk about hurricanes and impacts like that, there's a pretty good probability if you don't mind your commute will result in being out of power in both locations. It's just something to think about there for you entrepreneurs. But I got a good lineup for you today. I got six members of the expert council, a few we ain't heard from in a while, so that's always nice. And then I've got an anchor segment for you. Sean Mills will talk about smart meters, and this is kind of a follow-up on a past segment that he did on smart meters. And a very well-educated electrical company employee reached out to Sean with some counter-information, and Sean's going to read what he has to say and give some counter-thoughts to those. This is a very well-thought-out, very friendly discussion, but it is a better view of the whole, right? The whole as far as what the deal with smart meters really is. Andy McCann will talk about a hook grip. You don't know what a hook... It's not a martial arts technique in a video game. A hook grip is a method of gripping for weight training. And Andy will talk about, do you need to know it? Is it good to have? Is it useful? Is it pointless? Like, what's up with the hook grip? Doc Bones will talk about something called esophageal spasm. He's also going to talk about acid reflux, but the person asking this question doesn't have acid reflux. They just have esophageal spasm. I really was interested in hearing the answer to this myself, because this is something that happens to my wife on occasion, and it does seem like specific foods trigger it in specific people. What does it to my wife is different than this person, but it is the same result, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about it when we hear what Bones has to say, because I'm going to tell you, I've had it once or twice in my life. And it makes me have even more empathy for my wife when it happens to her, because it sucks, and it's actually pretty freaking scary. And the type we're talking about here, other than the acid reflux type, the type we're talking about here, it really is kind of scary. It really is. It ends up not being anything that if you just don't wait will go away, but if you've ever experienced it, it sucks. And I'll talk a little bit about it in case you're ever dealing with somebody that has it, so you understand if they seem scared or really upset, it is not an overreaction, especially if it's the first time and they're wondering if it's ever going to stop or get worse. Ben Falk will talk about using compost on a broadacre pasture, and I'm going to give you some of my follow-up thoughts. And I have sent this one also to Jeff Lawton. Haven't heard back. I may resend it because he's usually quick unless he's on the road to make sure he got it, because I'd like to get all three of us chiming in on this one. When you start looking at broadacre and compost, you know, it seems insurmountable, but there are some ways to turn compost into a force multiplier. Eric Hammond will talk about thoughts on crossover-style truck toolboxes. Now, this is not crossover SUVs. This is a type of toolbox, which Eric will explain what that means, and you've probably seen them plenty of times, just didn't know that's what they were called. Nick Ferguson will talk about invasive trees and not using certain invasive species as a fodder or a pioneer species tree. And this one in particular, I completely agree with Nick. I think a lot of trees people call invasive and worry about are not worth worrying about. This one, if I didn't have it on my property, I damn sure would not introduce it to my property. And he's doing a twofer, so he's also going to talk about a sick peach tree. He's going to give you what he thinks is wrong with the tree. I'm going to tell you, I actually think it's highly likely that it might be something else. But we concur on one thing, this tree is probably toast, and it's a very common issue, whether it's what Nick says it is or I say it is, with peach trees and anything in the prunus species, so your plums and stuff like that. And then I got an anchor segment that just kind of called out to me today, reading some of the people that are absolutely losing their mind with Trump derangement syndrome, and this is really not going to be about Trump, though. It's going to be about the fact that, you know, I talk about the left and right both being wrong all the time, both sides. The reason that I think we hit harder back at the left from this kind of either center point or anarcho-libertarian point is because the left are literally mentally ill at this point. And if you're a liberal and that upsets you and you're not mentally ill, then just relax, partner. I'm not talking about you. I want to talk about what's been done to people, especially our young people today, to the point where it is legitimately... I'm not kidding here. I'm not making a joke. I'm not punching down at people. I'm going to do about a serious 10 minutes on the concept that we have literally broken people mentally with this non-stop news cycle where they're not capable of thinking rationally, and why that is something to be concerned about for our children, our grandchildren, for our future, and for our country. Because I don't know if this is fixable in, you know, a single generation. I really don't. These people are mentally scarred, and I don't know if they can recover. You know, like, we get soldiers that come back from war and they have PTSD, and you can treat it and you can try to help them work through it, but I don't know that it ever really goes away. There's certain traumas that people have been through in their life, and they can live a completely functional life, but if you put them into a certain situation, that trauma comes back, and you can have things that a person who walks around with a normal blood pressure also has 170 over 120 blood pressure in that situation. It's not fake. And instead of mocking it, we should seek to understand it and figure out if there's something we can do about it. And I think that a lot of people that are on the left, they end up on the left because they're highly susceptible to propaganda. They're in that state. I understand that you get upset because they're the ones that vote for and push through all these stupid policies. But if we don't understand that the wound that has been inflicted on these people, I don't know if we can ever reach them. I have been at a point in my life where I'm like, we don't need to reach them. We just need to get rid of them. And when I say that, I mean just basically talk over them, design our lives around them. I don't mean I don't mean put them in a wood chipper or something like that. That's for pedophiles, not leftists. I think we need to have legitimate sympathy for these people, though. And I don't know how we coexist. I really don't. But at some point, with as many of them as they're doing this to, we're going to have to. And we're going to have to figure some stuff out. So I won't come at this as a mocking or an attack. I'm going to come at this with at least a little bit of sympathy. Because these people believe things that simply not only aren't true, they don't make any sense. And I'm not just talking about the transsexual crap and all that. I'm talking about just literally make no sense. And it's not that they say it, because people will say anything to get what they want. People will lie to get what they want. They believe it in their hearts and souls, and they're acting on things that are just not true. So this is going to be a very all-over-the-place expert panel show, which I think why many of you guys like these shows, because we cover so many different things. So let's drop in with a really interesting discussion from a very senior, high-level guy that knows his stuff in the electric company side of things, and Sean Mills on smart meters. I think this will be really interesting for everyone.
Hey guys, it's Sean Mills with Hack My Homestead, and this is going to be a little bit of a longer one today, but I actually got some feedback from a listener after my smart meter segment that I answered back in early April, and I wanted to cover some of the things that he sent in response in this segment, as well as kind of give some counterpoints. So, first of all, the employee of the power company that's actually sending this out is a pretty high-level guy. I'm not going to divulge his information, but we have actually communicated in the past, about for the past 5 years or so, and this guy absolutely knows what he is doing. He very smart and really understands the system as a whole, as well as what the utility is trying to do it, because he's coming to it from the utility side. So I'll read his response and then provide some counterpoints. Number one. All right, so Sean, I don't think you intended, but your answer to the smart meter question was filled with FUD. I offer the following in the best intent to try to clear that up, and I appreciate all that both you do for the community, meaning Jack and myself. Background, I work for utility leading our advanced nuclear efforts, but I was on the team reviewing our investment proposal for an automated metering initiative, or AMI, as project management SME, which means subject matter expert, back in 2015 when we went through our investment approval process. I had lots of tin hatter questions for the engineers and tech guys all the time. After reading my points below and some research on your own, I think it might be worth a clarification on air. So, counterpoints. Number one, the EMF on contact with a smart meter is approximately the same as using an old 900 megawatts or 2.4 gigahertz cordless phone back in the 90s. If you go a foot away, that drops off significantly as distance increases. 2x the distance equals 1/4 radiation. So if someone ever used a cordless phone, or better yet, has a whole house Wi-Fi system and a few 4G LTE or 5G cell phones they stick their head near all day, they're either full of crap that they have an EMF issue, unlikely to be sensitive to former cordless cell phone frequencies, or it's something else causing it. The data source I posted below is consistent with the data we had when we were approving the investment to move forward with automated metering. Number two, employees cost money. Every meter reader that can be eliminated saves the company money, and therefore the customer directly, in our regulated monopoly model. A little difference in unregulated places like ERCOR, but same principle. Are they highly paid? Nope. But at fully burdened, it's easily $60K a person, and that figures from 2015 when we approved the investment, and it's an aggregate of our cost across Arkansas, Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas, but not New Jersey. There are also overhead costs. A friend was a meter reader supervisor who also had a manager. Both of those positions are now eliminated. So more than 100 people in total. If someone insists on no smart meter, we'll do that, but we'll charge a fee to cover the cost of the meter readers who'd otherwise be fishing. It's only $10 a month right now, but when they are the last tin hatter without a smart meter, they'll be footing the full $60K bill, make that $90K bill due to inflation in 24, and the bill for his boss. Number three, the efficient operation of generators saves money. The better we predict load increases in real time at small increments rather than sensing voltage and frequency change due to a large load change on the grid, the better we can match generation to load and maintain 60 hertz. Getting the most efficient generators to load follow, keeping the less efficient ones turned off, and actually providing cleaner power to the grid, both from a fuel efficiency and a frequency perspective. Number four, we are very sensitive to customer data and generally don't give a shit what someone's doing with their power unless it's hurting the grid with things like massive inductive loads. Think 50 megawatt pumps, and we can work with someone like Shell to fix that. Can you opt into services where we send you some info? Yeah, kinda. But given any house is a mouse fart and customer level data really doesn't tell you much, I've pulled my full meter data set and it's super noisy to the myriad of things going on and off all the time. You can tell when my ACs turn on, and I can definitely see the days that I installed new crypto miners. My base load changed by 1,500 watts each time. The AMI guys asked, what the F did you start doing that day? But it's noise that the grid as a whole doesn't care about. We care about the data in aggregate to optimize our system. Number five, throttling power. There isn't any such thing unless you use a rheostat or something to incrementally add resistance upstream of the load but downstream of every other customer. And I know Sean wouldn't dispute that. Power is either on or off, and is just a connection between a source or a generator and a load, the conductor in the circuit. Smart meters don't have a rheostat that I know of. They need hella heat dissipation system to eliminate the waste heat. Would California turn someone off? Well, I wouldn't put it past those lunatic nut jobs. But anywhere you can buy an AR, drop this concern. We want you on more than anything else, as it affects every metric we have that gets us paid. There's an old saying in the industry, there's nothing sweeter than a spinning meter. If you made it this far, thanks for listening. Well, hey, man, I agree with a lot of what you said. Okay, so let's just go through the list. Number one, on the EMF stuff, I was very clear in my answer that I don't dispute my customers telling me that they have a sensitivity to something. I'm working with a lady that has an EMF sensitivity, according to her, and she doesn't have a Wi-Fi system in the house, and she doesn't use cell phones, and she doesn't have a lot of those things that you mentioned. So I'm not going to get into an argument about that. You confirmed what I said, which is they do provide background radiation. So we'll move past number one. For the vast majority of people, that's not going to mean anything. And for other people who are sensitive, it's going to mean something. But at the end of the day, that's their personal decision. About employees costing money, yeah, I agree with you there as well. I think that number two and number three, you're talking about, hey, smart meters allowed us to eliminate headcount, which is the most expensive and least reliable components of the system. And number three, talking about the efficiency of the generator. And by the way, the generator is the thing that produces power. We're not talking about, you know, like your portable plug-in generator. We're talking about the generator that's attached to the coal-fired boiler, right? And so I agree with you that the ability of the grid to be able to sense those changes and adjust to them so that you're generating power the most efficient way possible also saves money for the utility. And at the end of the day, the utility is trying to generate the most amount of power for the least amount of money. Now, part of that's because they have shareholders and they want to pay dividends so that they continue to get investments, so they continue to do things like putting smart meters in, right? So, yeah, part of that benefit aggregates to the customer, but the other part of the benefit aggregates to the investor. So let's be clear about that. You're very sensitive to customer data. I agree with you. One of the biggest topics in the last 2 years when I was in the power generation industry was security on the cyber side. What are you doing to make sure you don't introduce something into our system that gets us in trouble from a hacking standpoint? So I'm with you 100%. And then the last one, throttling power. There's no such thing unless you use a rheostat. I would imagine someone like Jack, who was turned off when the grid had too much load for the generators that were on grid to respond to, would say, hold on, there is throttling. It's not like you can only use 1,000 watts at a given time. It's you're off and the other side of the subdivision is on. And that's really the point I was trying to make, is the more data they have on a household by household, grid by grid basis, all these little subgrids, as the more data that they have there, when they get to the place where they have to actually pull things off the grid in order to shed that load, my contention was that they're going to utilize that data at that point. Who's using the power the way we want to and who's not? And you even mentioned, hey, even in California, it's a possibility. Well, guess what? These massive organizations, the top of those organizations get more like California every day. And I don't think that we should ignore that. I don't think that the power companies want anything other than happy rate paying customers. But when the time comes where the government is dictating things and causing them to do certain things, a smart meter installation over the course of an entire grid is absolutely going to cause that company to utilize that data to do the things that we don't think that they would ever do. And maybe we never get to that day, but I will maintain my position that having more detailed data at the household level that's available to the grid operator gives that grid operator the ability to make decisions utilizing data that they otherwise would not have had. So other than that, thanks so much for sending that information in. I really do appreciate it. And, you know, it is good information. I am not anti-grid at all. I know I'm the off-grid guy, but I say it every time I do a talk. Our grid is a modern miracle, and the way that it works is really fantastic and awesome, and I'm not anti-grid at all, but I'm also realistic when I answer questions about should I be concerned about this thing or not. And I think that all of those concerns are valid, whether or not they're going to be acted on right now or 20 years from now. So thanks again for getting that in. Sorry for going long today, but I wanted to read his full response and then respond to it myself. You guys keep getting those questions in the jack, and I'll keep getting them answered.
See, I agree with everything that Sean said, and I think it was a very even-handed discussion for both sides, especially given it was done on one side by email. And the one advantage I would say to email or text, basically, is that when you write something that long, you tend to read it a couple of times and make sure that you're understood. So I think that probably helped that conversation go better. Text can be the highest or the lowest form of communication depending on how careful the person writing the message is. And I think the person that wrote into Sean, and I'm pretty sure I know who this is too, did a pretty good job. Anyway, I will say, throttling may just not be the right word here, and that might be where the sticking contention is, because will they shut your shit off in rolling brownouts or rolling blackouts? Yes, because as Sean said, they did it to me, and they did it to like half the state by accident. Because what actually happened here during that major event wasn't a grid failure, okay? People that keep saying, fix this, need to fix this grid. Shut up. Quit running your mouth about a once-in-a-hundred-year weather event that there was one major outage for, and you don't even understand what happened. Simply put, because when that weather event hit, things froze up, and things like windmills didn't turn, and in a lot of places where windmills were, there wasn't any. There was a storm! No, it was a really fucking cold day. Really, really fucking cold week and a half, actually. And there wasn't a lot of wind with it. The damn windmills didn't turn, and then they really froze up. And there wasn't enough power being generated. So what the power company did, what ERCOT did, who manages all the power companies and manages the grid, did, so we got to shut power off. And what they were doing is they were shutting off about 20% of the load on a rotational 15-minute deal where it was supposed to be like, I'm out of power for 15 minutes. And then the power comes back on for 45, and then I'm out of power like that. That's how they were doing it. And they absolutely were targeting the areas of highest historical usage, and that information absolutely 100% did, I am sorry, come from what they knew about smart meters. And as they did it, they fucked it up, and they created a cascade. But the idea that they're going to slow down how much power comes to your house, he's right. Power is on or off, but that doesn't mean it can't be turned off. It also doesn't mean, because they can turn anybody's power off anytime they want, that they might not use an algorithm and some AI and shit to say, turn off these 50 people, or turn off these 500 people, or turn off these 5,000 people for a day. Like, you don't know what they're going to eventually do. But no, they are not going to basically make it so if you try to run more equipment in your home, it won't all work at once. He's dead on about that. So maybe throttle is not the right word. The right word is shut you the hell off whenever the hell they feel like it, and having a lot of data that can be used to determine who gets shut off because you use too much power. And if you could do that long enough to basically condition somebody, I better not use so much power, and don't think they won't do it, and I do not care what state you're in, because this idea that, well, we'll do it different in Texas, we'll do it in different in Alabama, no, no. You cannot trust the government at all, the end infinity, and when the federal government tells a giant corporation to do something, 9 times out of 10 they do it. So that's not me saying don't have a smart meter. I have a smart meter, but it's also me saying don't believe everything that somebody tells you, and I don't think this dude's lying. I just think that his judgment may be off a little bit in a few areas, but he's 90% right. I think that Sean and this guy actually agree more than they disagree. Anyway, on that, let's go ahead and take the next one. This is from Andy McCann, talking about weight training in relationship to what's known as a hook grip.
Hey guys, this is Andy McCann with CrossFit Garage here to answer your health and fitness questions coming from Woodstock, Georgia. And I have a question from Aaron Flanagan asking, what's the value of the hook grip and do I have to use it? So what is a hook grip? I love this question. I mean, I think maybe six of you in this community probably know what that is, and two of you probably care, but I think it is actually kind of valuable to know what it is, especially if you're going to be doing some lifting. So hook grip, if you take your hand and you grab the bar. So let's pretend you're doing a deadlift. The bar's at your shins. You reach down, you grab the bar. So just like a normal grip, your fingers go around, your thumb goes the other way, and you're gripping the bar. No big deal, right? So a hook grip, you would take your pointer finger and your middle finger, make a peace sign out of it while you're still gripping. Grip tight, hold on to everything, but make a peace sign or the number two or whatever with those two fingers, and then put those fingers back down over your thumb. So the idea here is I'm creating a stronger grip. This doesn't really work if the bar is too big or your hand is too small. So typically a guy is going to use the 45-pound or 20-kilogram Olympic lifting bar to do hook grips, and my hand's just too small to do it. I can like barely touch the top of my thumb, so it's not very useful. So a hack that I have is I use the lighter bar, the 35-pound bar, which is sometimes called the ladies bar, but I use it, so it's the Andy bar. And I can sort of hook grip in there, but I've been doing CrossFit for 15, 16, a long time, and I don't really ever hook grip. So I didn't learn it early on, so I don't use it now. So why do people do it? It's to create a stronger grip. Does it work? Well, if you go watch Olympic lifters lift and they're violently taking the bar off the ground to either their shoulders or overhead, then you're going to find, I think, 100% of them are going to be using the hook grip. So does it work? I'm going to say so, yes. Do you have to use it? I mean, the answer is no. I've been doing CrossFit for a very long time. I lift a lot of bars, and I never hook grip. Now, I do teach people how to do it, and some people say, rightly so, hey, Andy, this feels really weird. I don't like it. Well, don't do it. You don't have to use it. It does create it can create a more solid grip. So some people will use a wrist wrap, and I'll link these in Amazon. So if you want to find something that is similar, you can support Jack and buy them through his link on Amazon. But they'll put a basically a cloth around or a strip of, linen or whatever around their hand. And then you roll it and wrap it around the bar super tight, and then you grip it. And that's essentially doing the same sort of thing. Now, I am not a fan of using those because some people will use them when they do the bar overhead, which is not a great idea because if you want to bail out of that bar, it doesn't always unwind very well. I'll give you an example. So I don't, you know me, if you've been listening, you know I don't use any gear whatsoever. I may use some chalk or maybe a belt if my back's not feeling great. Usually I just don't do the thing. If I need a piece of something to help me do it, then I just find another way to do it or I lighten the load. Anyway, I have a girl at the gym, Sam, who was working on her bar muscle-ups. And she's like, hey, look at this. Do you think I could do it? I'm like, yes. If I give you a little push in the back, you're going to go up and it's going to be great. She's like, all right, let's give it a shot. She was using wrist wraps. So she had gymnastic grips. And I'll attach those too. So if you guys want to check them out, I don't use them. But I would say maybe 20 to 30% of the people in my gym do. So there is some value to them. Anyway, she got up there. The grip got underneath her hand. She did complete her muscle up, so that was awesome. And then her grip got under her hand. She went to come down, and as she let go, her hand was still pressing on that fabric, and it caught. So as she swung down, she did not let go because she couldn't. And so it slipped right out of her hand, and it kind of like bruised her hand a little bit. I guess the good side of that story is she shook her hand out, took a deep breath, went back to the bar about 5 minutes later and said, hey, I'm going to give it another shot. Will you give me a push in the back? I said, sure. And I didn't push her in the back, and she went straight up. So she's like, I did it on my own. I'm like, you totally did do it on your own. So did she need the gear? No. Did it help her, give her confidence? Sure. And that's great. If something's going to give you confidence, use it. If the hook grip gives you confidence, use it. If you can't hook grip and you want to try, just get a smaller diameter bar. If you go to Rogue, actually, I'll try to find some on Amazon. But typically, I buy gear from somewhere close to me. There's a guy down here in Dunwoody, Georgia area. Lynx Barbell, and so usually I buy stuff from him because I like to support local. If I can't find it from them, I buy from Rogue, which is basically just a big CrossFit shop, and they do have other stuff. But you can buy a smaller diameter bar, and that will help all you people with smaller hands like me. So The other thing that I know that I've seen, and it's, if I've witnessed it, it actually worked, is when an average Joe like me or you hook grips, it gives an Olympic lifter their wings. So if you want to pay it forward, start learning the hook grip. If you don't care about that, then you don't need to. The hook grip is useful, but it's not ultimately a must. It is nice to have, but again, like I said, I've been doing this for a lot of years, and I hardly ever hook grip. And when I do, so the problem with me is I've been doing it for so long, I've trained myself out of it. The weight is too heavy on my thumbs, and it feels like my thumb's going to explode. I think if you started doing this early on, you could train yourself into it. It would give you a better support, but the question is, what's the value of the hook grip? Just stronger grip. And do I need it? No, not really. No, funny little side story. The other thing you could do for getting a stronger grip, so Tim Nickerson was a coach of mine, and we were doing hang power cleans and at like 185, and the bar kept popping out of my hands. So I was like, hey, Tim. He's like, well, did you try chalk? I'm like, well, yeah, let me go do that. So I chalked my hands, and I sure enough popped right out. And he said, well, Andy, did you try gripping the bar harder? I'm like, don't be a jackass, but you know what? Let me give that a shot. So I paid attention to it, really thought about like squeezing down my hands, and lo and behold, the bar went up. So did I need a hook grip? No. Would it have helped in that situation? Yes. But thank you, Tim. I should have just gripped the bar holder. So, all right, there you go. Jack, what do you think?
So I had actually never heard of this, and I looked it up when I got the question. And, I mean, if you just put in hook grip weightlifting into a search engine, you'll find a ton of articles that show you exactly what it is. But what I would say is it's kind of like putting your thumb in the position when you're on the bar that would be the position that really stupid people put their thumb in when they're going to punch somebody and want to break their thumb, where the thumb is on the inside of the fingers that rather than the thumb on the outside of the fingers. So if you've ever seen somebody dumb enough to put their thumb like on their palm and then wrap their fingers around it, it's kind of like that. Now, you're not going to break your thumb doing it. And this is how I feel for most people, unless you're competing at really, really high levels where little things like this might get you a little bit higher and maybe able to win. It's probably not necessary. It's probably not something that makes a lot of sense. When I got the question, I'd really never heard it called that, but I had seen this grip and I thought I knew what it was, and when I looked it up, it was what I thought it was. When I used to spend a lot of time in gyms working out and stuff like that, there were some people that did it. It's not uniquely a CrossFit thing at all. It's more a powerlifting thing. And I think when you start doing things, and I do think the reason people that try it and end up not liking it, don't like it, it feels unnatural, because it is. It's just not the way that we would generally grip something. And I think when you have to start doing things in an unnatural way, the overall propensity for injury goes up. So my question for somebody that would be asking about this would be, what is your goal? And if your goal in lifting weights is to make yourself as healthy and fit and as much endurance as possible, this is probably a completely pointless thing. If your goal is to win competitions or something like that, maybe it's something to look into. I will also say, if you look it up, there are something called lifting hooks, and it's not really just a cloth that he's talking about. It's a literal like hook that straps on your wrist and then fits in your hand, and it helps hook. Like, it's like instead of shooting your bow and arrow with your fingers, you get a release. It's kind of something like that, right? I don't have a lot of use for those either. And again, even when I lifted weights all the time, and I was training like 4 days a week back in the day, so to say, nothing like that ever appealed to me. Like, I think that natural movement, natural grips, and natural functional fitness is the way to go. You can differ. I'm just giving you my opinion on this question. Now let's hear about something called esophageal spasm from Dr. Bones.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. This week's question for the expert council comes from Hendrick, who writes, what foods do I eat or what natural medicines do I take to heal an inflamed esophagus? Every so often when I eat something, I feel the inside of my throat start to close up and hurt. During this event, I am unable to eat or drink without major discomfort. After a short while, it calms down again. It often happens when I eat cooked legumes and leafy greens. Hendrick. Hendrik, the most common cause of esophageal problems is acid reflux, but since you don't complain of any burning sensation or acid taste in your throat, I'm going to assume it's not that. But since a lot of people have it, I guess I should mention ways to get rid of it. If you've been having repeated episodes of heartburn or any symptom of acid reflux, well, you might try the following. You should eat sparingly and slowly. When the stomach's very full, there can be more reflux into the esophagus. Eat small meals more frequently rather than three large meals daily. Avoid certain foods. There are some foods that are more likely than others to trigger reflux, including mint, fatty foods, spicy food, tomatoes, onions, garlic, coffee, tea, chocolate, and alcohol. You want to also avoid carbonated beverages. They're pretty acidic and they make you burp, which sends acid into the esophagus. Drink flat water instead of sparkling water. Stay up after eating. When you're standing or even sitting, gravity alone helps keep acid stay in the stomach where it belongs. Finish eating 3 hours before you go to bed. This means no naps right after lunch and no late suppers or midnight snacks. You want to avoid vigorous exercise for a couple of hours after eating as well. An after-dinner stroll, that's fine, but a more strenuous workout, especially if it involves bending over, can send acid into your esophagus. Also, you want to sleep with your head at least 6 to 8 inches higher than your feet. Use extra tall bed risers on the legs supporting the head of your bed or a foam wedge. If you're heavy, lose weight. Increased weight decreases the pressure needed to keep acid in your stomach. This leads to reflux and heartburn. If you smoke, quit. Nicotine can relax the lower esophageal sphincter and also cause acid to go up your esophagus. And you want to check your meds. Some meds like postmenopausal estrogen, tricyclic antidepressants, and anti-inflammatory painkillers can relax the sphincter, while others, particularly bisphosphonates taken to increase bone density like Fosamax and the like, they can irritate the esophagus. So I've just spent a lot of time on what I don't think you have, Hendrik. Sorry about that. That leaves what can be best described as esophageal spasm. For those who don't know, an esophageal spasm is the abnormal squeezing, sudden usually, of the pipe that travels from your oral cavity to your stomach, also known as the esophagus. The main symptoms are difficulty swallowing and chest pain. The spasms can be severe enough to make you actually wake up from being asleep and can feel like a heart attack to some people. Other symptoms of esophageal spasms can include feeling like something's stuck in your throat, backward flowing of food or drink, that's called regurgitation, and some people can experience heartburn as well. Very hot foods or liquids can trigger spasms or make them worse. Use of certain medications like narcotic pain relievers like opiates may cause esophageal spasms in some. Doctors really aren't sure what causes esophageal spasms, but it's known that they're a type of motility disorder. That means there's a problem with how the muscles in the food pipe squeeze together, contract in other words, to move contents through the rest of the GI tract. Normally, nerve signals from the brain tell the muscles in your esophagus to contract when you swallow something. Faulty nerve signaling may play a role in whether or not you develop this condition. There are two main types of spasms you should know about. Distal esophageal spasm, or diffuse esophageal spasm, that's also called DES. These are uncoordinated spasms that often happen all along with regurgitation. That means food and liquids come back up after you swallow them. Then there's nutcracker or jackhammer esophagus. This condition is caused by a twisted or corkscrew-shaped esophagus, and it's often involved in powerful spasms. Regurgitation is not common with this particular type. Esophageal spasms, these are really rare, but they're more likely if you are between the ages of 60 and 80, have esophageal reflux disease, gastroesophageal reflux disease, also known as GERD, have high blood pressure, deal with anxiety or depression, drink a lot of red wine or spicy foods, drink very hot or very cold drinks, but interestingly enough, the cooked legumes and the leafy greens you mentioned aren't on the list. Because spasms cause symptoms similar to a heart attack, your doctor may first run tests to check your heart health. It's important to rule out angina, which is a type of chest pain caused by coronary artery disease, and also GERD. You may have both gastroesophageal reflux disease, GERD, and esophageal spasms at the same time. Now, tests your doctor may order include an upper endoscopy. That's where a doctor inserts a flexible scope with a camera on the end into your esophagus to see your esophagus and stomach. It can help diagnose or rule out GERD or other GI conditions. An ultrasound performed during an endoscopy can show thickening of the esophageal lining that can trigger esophageal spasm. Another test is a barium swallow. You drink a thick, chalky liquid called contrast dye before having an x-ray of your esophagus, and the images show how well the liquid moves from your esophagus to your stomach. This test can help to diagnose the nutcracker or jackhammer type of esophageal spasm. The acid test for spasms is something called manometry. This is the only test that can confirm esophageal spasms as the problem. During this procedure, a doctor inserts a thin tube into your esophagus. Sensors on the tube measure pressure in the esophagus and reveal how well the muscles relax when you swallow. These painful events can happen without warning and are often challenging to treat. Options for treatment include medications. The goal of taking medicine is to relax the smooth muscle of the esophagus. One of the most common natural recommendations may be to take peppermint oil or licorice lozenges. Sometimes menthol works as well. Thought to be natural ways to relax smooth muscle. Now, if this doesn't work, you may be asked to try a calcium channel blocker like amlodipine, which is also given for heart issues, or an antidepressant called a tricyclic antidepressant. Botox injections into the esophagus have been also known to help. This treatment relaxes the muscles of the esophagus, and it's considered helpful for people with spasms. The relief is temporary. You'll need repeated injections about every few months. So far, the only curative treatment seems to be surgery, specifically a surgical procedure called myotomy. The surgeon cuts the thick muscle in the lower part of the esophagus, and that somehow relieves the problem. This is only recommended, of course, in severe cases when medications and injections don't work. So earlier I gave you strategies for acid reflux, but there are also some for esophageal spasms. You can, one, know and avoid your triggers. Make a list of the things that cause your spasms and work to stay away from them. Two, watch food and drink temperature. Give foods that are very hot and very cold a chance to come to a more moderate temperature before you eat or drink them. Control your stress. Stress ramps up spasms, so try to keep a check on your stress levels. Dietary factors that commonly trigger esophageal cramps include red wine, spicy food, and food that's very hot or cold, like I just mentioned. Besides everything I've mentioned, you should also stay away from very constrictive clothing. Hendrick, I hope this helps. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn about important off-grid medical topics in the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
So I'll caveat this with saying that I'm not a doctor, and he knows a lot more than me about stuff like this, and that's why he's here, okay? I'll also say that it tends to be the case that when something affects you, you often know more about it than a generalist who knows more about a thing than you in general, or at least a specific version of it that you're dealing with. In other words, my wife is like the queen of weird stuff when it comes to health. She had a condition known as trigeminal neuralgia. It generally only affects people that are in upper years, because I'm not going to get deep into it, but the way that it usually happens is arterial. Hers was venal, meaning it was a vein, not an artery, constricting the trigeminal nerve in the jaw or along the jaw. And I can probably sit down with even a lot of neurologists, and I know a shitload about trigeminal neuralgia that they don't. And a general practicing physician, I find, doesn't know the square root of F all about trigeminal neuralgia. That's not the case here. Okay, this is a little bit different, but I'm making the point. You want to know about, let's say, a specific type of cancer, talk to someone who survived it or is fighting it. And they will generally know more if it's a weird, non-typical cancer than even an oncologist, because it's more important to them. The reason that most general practitioners don't know much about trigeminal neuralgia, for instance, is because when they get a person that has it, they refer them to a neurologist. And so they never really work very much with somebody that has it. And their neurologists, you know, are dealing with, for every 100 cases, maybe one is trigeminal neuralgia. This condition is not that common when it's in the form that I'm about to describe. So my wife does not have a twisted esophagus, and neither do I. Neither one of us really have any other health problems. We certainly don't have any form of reflux that goes along with this. This is something that seemingly comes out of nowhere, and I've experienced it like twice in my life, so I have an empathy to it, and I've seen my wife deal with it a good couple dozen times over, you know, like 10 years. It's not chronic. And what will trigger it for her, it seems like more than anything else, is eating too fast when she's really hungry, and for her, the food type is usually either ham or chicken. I've never seen this to happen to her when she eats beef or vegetables or anything else. It's usually white meat chicken, you know, like 99% of the time, and I've seen it happen to her once eating some ham. And again, it's like if she hadn't eaten in a really long time and she eats faster than she should. And what happens is the esophagus literally does go into a spasm, and it feels like you're trying to swallow something you can't prevent yourself from swallowing, and yet there's nothing there. And it freaking hurts. And it can last 20 seconds, it can last a few minutes. And a few minutes feels like a friggin' hour. And so I think if that's what this person's experiencing or somebody in this audience is experiencing, what I would say is identify the food types that cause it and avoid them as much as possible if it's an every time thing. If it's something more like my wife's, where like she'll eat chicken 100 times and it's the 101st time that this happens because she's eating too fast, she's really hungry. Definitely then avoid those foods when you're first eating a food. Don't tell a person experiencing this, well, drink water, because that will not help. And it's not really possible when it's going on, honestly. And just support them and explain to them that it will go away and be patient. And understand if you've never experienced it, you don't know what that person's feeling. And it is very uncomfortable. It is very painful, and if it's a longer-lasting event, and it is the first time it happens, I can see that it would be quite disturbing and frightening, and that person really doesn't know what's happening, and may even feel that they're having a cardiac event. These are not cardiac events, but since the pain is pretty much wherever the esophagus is spasming, it could be spasming way up near the throat, it could be spasming way down near the stomach, or it could be spasming right about the middle between the throat and the stomach. And if it's doing it there, it's pretty close to where your heart would be. And the mind does things to people. So that's kind of my kicker into this one. It is certainly the case. I would try the be careful and adjust diet and eating habits before I would let somebody inject Botox into any part of my body, but let alone my esophagus. I'll throw a little thing out here. I know that a lot of people use Botox now for cosmetic purposes. I think injecting the most deadly toxin known to man into your body for the purpose of removing a wrinkle is stupid, and I don't think you should do it. Anyway, moving on, let's go ahead and hear about increasing pasture fertility and whether or not compost can play a role in that with Ben Falk.
Hey, Jack and all. Ben Falk with Whole Systems Design. Question about would using compost be a good strategy for increasing organic matter and soil fertility in pastures? And then the context of this Oklahoma site and it being 60 acres in pretty rough shape, low organic matter, like most of the world, really. Classic example of it depends. So, well, to start off, yes, of course. Like, the more compost, the better on any land. If you could wave a magic wand and apply compost to land, you basically always would. Unless you were going to put parking or a building or similar on that ground. But as far as being productive, biologically productive ground, yes, compost is always a good thing. You'll never have enough, you know. If you want to just boil it down to yes or no, which is the way the question's posed. but maybe I'm being a little blunt. I mean, because the questioner said, would it be a good strategy? In this context, and that answer is probably no. Because it's acres and acres. So to apply a meaningful amount of compost over even an acre is a ridiculous amount of compost. I mean, you can look up the the calculations. But to add, you know, 1 inch of material on an acre is an absurd amount of material, you know, like dump truck loads of material. So even if you had a compost producer next to your site giving away compost, you know, you'd be hard pressed to spread a lot of compost on 60 acres. I mean, if you had the equipment, yeah, but even then you're burning a lot of fuel. You're impacting the land by driving around on it. That may or may not be a big issue depending on the soil type and how compacted it already is or would be made if it was, let's say, clay versus sandy. Grade, obviously, steepness matters with that to some extent. But short of that, which is obviously the case, no one's giving away free compost, you're not gonna have enough compost or necessarily the means to apply it well to 60 acres. So what I'm trying to get at is what you're already doing, good grazing, mob stock, intensive rotational grazing, cover cropping, grazing down cover crops, that kind of thing is going to be a more practical way to build organic matter, on farm scale sites. Now, if you're talking gardens, raised beds, sure, bring in the compost. But over a broad acre, it's just not going to be a practical thing, in my opinion and experience. I would also caution against picking a specific goal of, let's say you said 5% organic matter. Why 5%? I mean, you can achieve, you know, I doubt your goal is 5% organic matter as much as it is a certain output of production, a certain economic viability of the site, a certain level of health of the site, et cetera, et cetera. So I wouldn't pin it to something subordinate like a percent organic matter, because you might be able to meet other goals with a lower organic matter percentage. Depends on a lot of things, climate, soils, et cetera. Sometimes you could have a performance, so to speak, from a 3% organic matter soils that rivals an 8% in a different climate. I think what you're already doing is great, and you're seeing major improvements, you wrote in all caps, which is not surprising, and I'm glad you are seeing those improvements, and I'm it makes sense that you are, given what you're doing. You wrote that you're doing long rest periods with cows, pigs, and poultry. That's hard to beat. I mean, pigs on the roughest area as a renovation strategy, and then getting them out of those areas and moving it to more permanently or semi-permanently into the rotational grazing of cows with the poultry. If you can find an economic output for, you know, meat birds, especially, or eggs, but especially broilers, there's no faster kind of revving up of good pasture than chickens, because you're essentially scratching in fertilizer. Hopefully you can have organic grain input paid for, which is essentially fertility, to get really good grasses and forbs and, you know, legumes going. And then with the cows as a double whammy, you're going to build up organic matter and health of soil quickly that way. So it sounds like you're already doing that. I would try to focus on that even more. I would only focus on applying compost in very specific areas where you're necessarily going to do veggies, for instance, if you have an acre or two. I mean, that's great. You have a lot of access to wood chips and they will compost. You're not going to want to really just spread even really well rotted wood chips out on land that you want to be pasture, because it's going to be fungal focused rather than bacterial. Pasture is more of a bacterial dominated soil. But yeah, I mean, eventually, if you compost that fully, it will be. But again, you're going to want to surgically focus that on a 60-acre context. Composting that with animal, it's not waste, animal manures, because you wrote, I've got plenty of animal waste. Waste is a resource misplaced, so you're not going to misplace that, it sounds like. So it's not waste, but animal manures, animal fertility, Yeah, make a ton of comp. I would probably just spread that back. I would feed out on pasture in winter, by the way, to build up soils, rather than probably concentrate it and then have to spread it or make compost out of it. I would just get it right back out directly. Probably. I don't know a lot about your site, not having been there, and there's no goals form I'm looking at here. So there's a lot of other context that's important, but I would tend not to want to process all that. Would biochar be another option? You wrote, I think biochar is an amazing tool, but again, it runs into some like practical contextual challenges given your scale. I would try to make biochar if you have the time. Again, there's a lot of, it depends. How much time do you have? How much extra bandwidth, resources, money to like focus on doing something new? But sure, in an ideal world, making biochar, adding it to your hottest manures like chicken, poultry, getting that into the ground or, you know, onto the ground, sure, but it's not on 60 acres probably, but on a few acres potentially that you might want to crop, like annual crop. So, yeah, that would be my main input, at least in brief. Thanks a lot. And it sounds like you're just already doing great, moving in the right direction, and just give it some time. It doesn't sound like it's been all that long. Fourth summer, you're at 5.5%. I don't know what you were at right at the beginning, but you know, you got to give it some time. It's a lot of years of abuse, as you've experienced there, isn't going to fix itself in just a few years. Depending on the compaction of the soil, you may want to subsoil and break things up with like a key line plow, but I didn't see anything about, you know, a soil test. There's a lot of chemistry to keep in mind. I mean, I would definitely do a soil test, and then you may want to do some decompaction with like deep key line ripping potentially, and adding even organics into that. Like, people are starting to apply like waste milk and like biologicals, you know, into the rip sowing and sowing seed. The Vermont rip sower is a version of the key line plow where people are doing that. Abe Collins, stuff like that may be applicable, would be applicable to your scale. So awesome work. Keep it going.
So on this, when you're looking at 60 acres and you're looking at the conventional way that we use compost, it's a non-starter. I mean, Ben's right about that. You're just not going to put compost on 60 acres. You probably can't afford to make enough or to buy enough in to put it down the way that we think about it in a garden, or even a, you know, like a 1-acre orchard or something like that. The good news is you can boost your fertility and you can boost the health of your pasture without doing that and still use compost. So this, now, I am kind of pushing my own course here a little bit, but bioreactor compost is the type of compost we need to use in this situation. So Dr. Johnson, who created this compost, has trialed it at a rate of 400 pounds to the acre. And you would need a very specialized piece of machinery to even begin to be able to do that level of distribution. If you run a machine that does that over, let's say, one square foot floor tile in white, so it'll show up, it'll look like somebody took a pepper shaker over it and shaked a little bit of pepper on it. Like if it was your plate of food, you'd say that damn well ain't enough. And that has a massive impact on the soil biology that actually builds the fertility. Because I think most people don't understand why compost improves their fertility. It is not because of NPK. It is not because of the organic matter in the compost in of itself. It's due to the biological activity of the compost. And this is why most of the compost that you can buy in a bag is absolute horrendous garbage. And even much of the stuff you can buy in bulk from larger facilities is pretty much garbage. It is organic matter-based fill, but it won't do what you expect compost to do because it doesn't have the biological activity. So 400 pounds to the acre. Here's the bad news. On 60 acres, that's still 24,000 pounds. A bioreactor of the type that I teach you to make in my course, available at homefoodsystems.com, will be 300 to 400 pounds when finished. So one bioreactor, you need 60 bioreactors for that application rate. Here's the better news, though. You don't need to do that either. What you need is a good system for spraying. And you can then spray that pasture, and one bioreactor will make you enough to probably spray half of it, 30 acres. And if you want to know more about that, again, homefoodsystems.com, you can take my course. It's only $40. I believe that course way more than pays for itself, just in what it can do for someone in this position. And I would definitely consider doing that. And I would actually tell you to pick 10 acres and spray it really well multiple times through a rotation and see the difference that it makes and give yourself the confidence it's worth investing on doing the whole property. And that way you'll actually know what it did for you, because if you are grazing it properly, and properly is the key phrase here, and that's a fairly heavy stock density necessary for something of that size, it's going to improve whether you do the other part or not. So it's probably a good idea to know how much of the improvement you can bet on what you've done with grazing and how much of the improvement it comes from using a compost and the biology that you're introducing into it. But I also want to say something about what Ben said about organic matter. This is very true, and I have learned more than I'm teaching in doing these courses, is one way I would put it. And what I mean by that is I am having to dig into things, thinking of myself as I put these courses together. If I'm a student and I heard an instructor say that, what question do I have? And then deciding, well, I'm going to build the answer that I would have if I were the student into the presentation so that, and then what would, and I keep cascading through there. And one of the things I've learned in my research is that while it is great and noble that we would want to increase organic matter in all our agricultural sites to at least 2%, and if we did that, we would literally sequester all carbon humans have produced in 100 years. The number itself is something that we need to be careful that we don't become addicted to a number and create a goal for that number, as Ben was saying, just because it's a number that sounds good. 5% organic matter is incredibly rich, healthy soil, and you can get way beyond that in a garden pretty quick. Doing it in a pasture is going to take some time to do. And there are also places where it will probably never happen, a 5% organic matter or 4% organic matter. There are different soil types of your primary soil base, and some climates combined with soil types result in a very rapid carbon cycle. And so some of the places, for instance, and some of the really great places to grow stuff in the higher elevations in California, for instance, have soils that do this and climates that aid with it. And if you have a 2 to 3% organic matter rate there, you're about as good as you're going to get, because you're constantly cycling the carbon in and out of soil much more rapidly. And that's not necessarily bad. If the plants are doing well, if you're doing pasture and the pasture looks good and the livestock are healthy and it's very productive and you're not dealing with constant problems, then your organic matter is probably where it needs to be. And if it continues to grow, great. And if it doesn't, but you don't have any problems, be okay with it. Because I think there are people that almost want, I want 5%, or I went from 0 to 5%. And it sounds like they're setting that goal for themselves based on almost bragging rights. And that is not how to manage pasture. The next thing I'll say is, if you really want to increase the organic matter in pasture, I'm going to say a word here that you probably wouldn't think I'd say, but you would only do it on the first time that you would do this. You might actually end up in some selective areas tilling. Oh, God, Jack says, hold on, and planting good cover crops that make good forage. And once you did that, you can graze and reseed without ever doing it again. And if you can seed without plowing to establish those, you should, but you probably can't. Okay? So it would be a very shallow plowing, maybe even just a base disking, and then putting and doing it at the right time, the right crop, the right way. I am over halfway done producing the cover crop course. It would be worth taking for you when it's done, but it's really not geared towards 60-acre pasture. It's really everything I'm doing, site's called Home Food Systems for a reason, is designed for people with gardens, homesteads, and market garden-sized farms. But it would still be, you'll learn a ton. And I would tell you to look into the work being done by people like Ray Arculeta and Gabe Brown with cover crops, because if you do, that is much more geared toward what you're trying to accomplish than just standard composting, because it's untenable and it's not financially sustainable to make enough compost for that level. Again, even at 400 pounds an acre, we're looking at 12 tons. 12 tons. That's a lot of bioreactors for 60 acres. But, you know, you're probably looking at, to make enough extract to spray an acre, about a 1 gallon Ziploc bag of compost. So 60 gallons of compost is very doable. It's very doable. And it will, and when you're done using it, it can still be used and scattered around places that maybe you want a more intensive effect. Because just because you've made an extract with it, which is not a tea, an extract is very quick to make, 1 to 10 minutes in the water, and it's out and ready to go. If you take that approach, then places that you maybe you have trees or shrubs, or you know, if you're running like a silvopasture model, is what you want to do. Along those tree lines is where I would spread that residue of that compost. All right, with that, let's go. That's a long answer from me adding on to that one, but I think it's a complex situation. Let's hear about truck toolboxes here from Eric Hammond.
Greetings, Eric Hammond here with another expert counsel question from Brian, who wants a recommendation on a crossover style truck toolbox. So that would be one that goes up there by the cab of the truck and then goes from bed rail to bed rail. And he wants one that's going to be under $1,000. He's looked at some of the reviews on the cheaper boxes, and a lot of them just seem to be trash. He's not a contractor or mechanic, but he just wants to put stuff from under the back seat of the truck into a reasonably safe toolbox. It's not going to be junk in a few years. And he may store some firearms in the box for very short term. It looked like he has a 2018 Silverado. So yeah, Brian, when you look at some of these cheaper toolboxes, they do seem to be like they are crap. They are kind of garbage, but they fit a role for a lot of people. You know, most of them are made probably at the same factory. They look like they're all pretty much the same, and then somebody just slaps their own brand sticker on them. You go to Home Depot, Lowe's, you see all these things. For just keeping stuff out of the weather, if you just went with the opinion of, I'm going to put this in the back of my truck bed, if somebody walks by and takes it, like, no big deal. But if I put it in this toolbox, then at least it's out of the weather. That kind of is where those kind of fit in that role. You got to know that, like, truck toolboxes are not a very secure item. So the really cheap ones, man, you could get into that with a pry bar in the right spot pretty easily. But the weak link on these things is, like, the locks are always really low security, poorly designed locks. You could punch one out with a screwdriver. There are some higher-end toolboxes, and I will go into that. I just want you to kind of know that, like, at least in this area, this truck toolbox that's sitting in the back of your truck, that's like a treasure chest for crackheads. Like, there could be anything in there, you know? So they just want to know what's inside. Typically, they're all very low security, so they really want to get in them. And then when you're transferring items from inside of your truck to your toolbox, like, people could see you moving these items of value wherever you're at into this box and locking it up. And so that could be a pretty poor idea. I'm not sure that I would store a firearm in, or anything of value, in a truck toolbox box. I would still go with the idea or the assumption that if it's in the bed of my truck and I would leave it, then it's cool to put in the truck toolbox as well. But even like just a vehicle in general is a pretty low security place. you know, these side glasses and the back glass of a truck, it's this tempered glass that shatters into a million pieces within seconds if you just use like an automatic center punch. So somebody could get in your truck, take anything almost immediately. But at least like in your vehicle, if there's a firearm tucked up under the seat or something of value tucked up under the seat, they don't see you transfer that item of value in and out of it. And then, you know, if it's out of sight, out of mind, if you had just slightly tinted windows where it's kind of hard to see into your vehicle, but they can kind of look in and see there's nothing really of value in there, that's probably a decent measure for making sure that people don't try and steal your stuff. As far as higher end toolboxes that fit this $1,000 and under budget, there are some brands that stick out, like WeatherGuard makes one. It's going to be right there at the top of your budget. They're a lot better fit and finish. Still has the same poor quality locks in it, but it's a much nicer, better fitting toolbox. One that I really kind of like that I've been looking into is this brand called Decked. I hate their marketing. I think that's kind of off-putting to me, but the product looks awesome. It's almost like the plastic they use for kayaks or the Yeti coolers or something like that, and then they reinforce it with a bunch of metal. Instead of using those gas-filled struts to hold the lid up that always end up failing, so the lid's constantly hitting you when you open it, they use like a torsion spring in there. So there's really nothing to wear out. They look awesome. There's even options to put like a ladder in it so that you can actually step up off the side of your truck and reach the center of the box without having to get in the bed. They look like they're a pretty secure box. I would look into the deck. I would look into the WeatherGuard, and I hope that that helps you get it kind of narrowed down. But, you know, just don't keep anything super valuable inside of there. If anybody else has any questions, shoot them my way, and I will get them answered. It could be gas, diesel, electric, two-stroke, four-stroke, anything mechanical that's interesting and it doesn't work, but it should. Just send the questions my way. Thanks.
So I have a few add-ons here and some different ideas, and I'm going to start off with improving security with an understanding of something. Locks are impediments, not preventatives to theft. You show me the lock, and I can probably get in. And if I can't, I know someone who can. I'm pretty good at picking locks, and he's right. Those locks on those boxes, I'm not even going to bother to pick one of those if I don't care about damage. I can blow one of those locks out of those boxes really, really fast. But most other locks I can pick. And there was one time I had a lock I couldn't pick, and it was back when I still lived really close to Brian and Kelly Black, and I called Brian up, and he came and he picked that lock in about 2 minutes flat. So everything I'm about to say doesn't make anything Eric said not true. It just means that if I make it harder for you to steal, and I make it take more time for you to steal from me, and I make it noisier for you to steal from me, you're less likely to do it, especially like if it's parked in a store parking lot and you think about where you park and things like that, right? Because he's right. Depending on where you live and how bad, you know, petty theft and shit like that is, as soon as a person that's up to doing that sees a toolbox, they're already counting the money from the pawn shop. But one thing that I have done with those types of over the rail toolboxes, because they're so obvious that that's what it is, you can see it, is I'll put two big heavy-duty hasps with heavy-duty bolts like Dura-Torx on them, one on each side. And it does not to replace the lock in the box. It is to enhance it. So now you've got two hasps to get rid of plus the lock for the box. Just a thought. If I was really worried about theft, and I'm just going to say I wouldn't put a firearm in there at all. I just wouldn't. No. It is way more likely to get stolen out of there than it is, like he said, concealed inside the vehicle itself. Okay? But if I really am concerned about theft and I want a toolbox, and it would limit some of the bulk of, like, you're not going to carry a circular saw in a box like I'm about to give you, but most of the tools that we need, like for mechanic work and stuff like that, will fit in these. The boxes that literally sit flat in the bottom of the bed, and when you're outside of the truck and you're looking, you don't even know it's there. And you drop the tailgate, and it'll have two or three long slide out doors. If it's a 6-foot bed, you have almost a 6-foot drawer that'll slide out of the truck. And those are just more secure in general because people are less likely to see them. They also cost more, but if you're going to already invest in a much better box, then that's not, they don't cost much more anymore, if you get what I'm saying. The other thing that you can do with those, if your truck has like a spray-in bed liner or something like that, they make the stuff that you can, I can't remember what it's called now, but you can basically paint the bed of your truck with to make a spray-in bed liner, except you can roll it in. Buy the color of that stuff, just a small amount of it, like a quart of it, because it is kind of expensive, that matches that liner in your truck. And this isn't going to fool, let's say, the drug enforcement police at the Mexican border, but it makes it way less likely that someone knows that you have tools in a toolbox. Take a piece of like 5/8, 3/4-inch good quality plywood, cut it to fit into the bed of your truck, paint it with that bed liner stuff. Again, I just can't remember what it's called now, but I can see the can in my head. And lay that in there and bolt it into the on top of the box. And if somebody really looks, well, they're like, oh, there's a false bottom there. But if you're just walking by, you're not really going to notice that, especially if there's other shit in the truck that's the kind of stuff like, you know, garbage or junk or, you know, kind of thing people don't generally steal. Or, you know, things that are so low value they're not worth, like, you know, cinder blocks or something sitting on top of it. They're really not going to notice it, yeah? Then the other side of that, the additional security, is how do you access that box? Well, you drop the tailgate, and then you open the box locks itself. You got to get the lock open, and usually, or at least some of them will have individual locks per drawer. So if there's two big drawers split in half, right, they're going to have two, each has its own lock. So now I got a lock or two more I got to get past. But if I have a locking tailgate, and almost every pickup truck made in the last 15 to 20 years comes with a locking tailgate because tailgate theft became a problem. So now you got to figure out that it's there. You got to unlock the tailgate. You got to unlock the box. And you got to do that all while you hope you don't get caught. The deal with the hasps on the standard boxes, the big deal with them is I can blow that right off with an angle grinder, but they're loud. And crooks do not like loud. They like to get in, get out fast. So remember, whenever you're dealing with potential two-legged rats, these are people who do get really good if they're going to do it for any length of time, if they're a professional at it, right? Even if they're a rank amateur, if they're not in jail, and they've done it more than a few times, they've gotten pretty good at it, or they'd be in jail. And so they're pretty good at risk-reward. So when you're driving around with a great big tool, shiny toolbox, and it's parked somewhere that there's some cover to get to it, and I know all I got to do is pop that one lock and I'm in there, that's a low risk, high reward in the mind of that person. If they're even looking at that box and you park somewhere that they don't have a lot of cover, that they're going to be seen, and they got to get two hasps locks off plus the box lock, I'm going to go steal, you know, Ted's over here and leave Bill's alone. I'm not saying it won't get broken. I'm saying you're reducing the probability. So just some additional things to think about there. But I really like the in the bottom of the bed boxes if they'll hold the things that you want. And they will hold like a full-size AR because I've seen it done. And the other nice thing about putting that thick plywood over it, those boxes sit in between the wheel wells. And so aft and forward of the wheel wells in a standard pickup bed, if you put any material back there, mulch, dirt, something like that, it's going to fall down in there, and it's a bitch to get out. By pushing that board out to the edges and custom fitting it, you get a nice smooth surface if you want to haul mulch or something. And you don't give up the space. You make a 6-foot bed and put a 2-foot box in it, it became a 4-foot bed. yes, you'll lose some depth, but you keep the full length of your bed. So I just think, again, as long as what you want to carry will go in them, it's a better solution. Anyway, let's move on. Now we have one from Nick Ferguson. It's a twofer.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson from Homegrown Liberty and RarePlantStore.com here with an expert counsel answer for John on nasty invasive trees and Philip on a dead peach tree. I've got a twofer today because these should be pretty short and to the point. Is Allianthus altissima a good fit in a silvopasture system? Info, we are slowly building out a 10-acre silvopasture system in Zone 9 south of Sacramento, California. Why are you still there? We already supplemented with willow and mulberry, but need more shade in our south paddocks. I've gotten dozens of chip drops this winter. Most of it I allowed to rot for months before application. Great. But some I used immediately for mulch. Those areas now have shoots of several species, including what the plant app says is Allianthus. The only info I can find is that the female flowers stink and that it grows fast. Is this a potential shade and fodder plant? Well, Allianthus is also known as Tree of Heaven, and it's an invasive tree that, in my humble opinion, is good for nothing but natural pesticide. As Trump likes to say, he's a nasty guy. I'll spare you the Trump impression. I've been on the road all day, and I'm too beat for trying to do impressions. So, yeah, they're nasty guys. Unfortunately, it's not a good candidate for much of anything good. I can't stand the trees. Okay, they're probably good for one thing, remediation of horrific soil conditions. Down near the lakeshore, I have an ash pile from burning some brush, and the only thing growing in it is Allianthus. If that says anything about it, it's growing straight out of a 4-inch deep ash layer. Nothing but that tree growing there and some moss. So, yeah, it's good for that, but for a healthy silvopasture system, I'd cut those down, and I'd either burn the stumps if you want to go no herbicide, or I'd paint with some herbicide if you want to use a shortcut and get it done quick and effectively. Stuff like that is probably one of the only instances, the rare instances, where I'd be willing to use an herbicide since it's a spot application and a tiny amount. Short answer, but hopefully a good one. Next question is from Philip, and he says, question for expert counsel, question for the Nick. What is this marmalade-looking goop at the base of my peach tree? Thanks. Well, he included a picture of what looks like some orange marmalade that someone dumped out at the base of the peach tree. And actually, that's called gummiosis, and judging by the volume and location and what the soil looks like and everything, I'd say it's most likely bacterial canker, and just looking at the bark and how bad it looks, I'm willing to say that tree's a goner. Gummiosis can occur with lots of different kinds of damage to Prunus genus trees. That tree is basically pushing a sap compound out to hopefully clear out the infection or insect. It's basically tree pus. So, yeah, sorry to be the bearer of bad news, but I'd bet a grand that that tree's toast. Best practices, judging by the ground around the tree, for where you live, I have no clue where you are, so this advice could vary greatly, so I'm just giving you some general information. But the next time you plant, make sure you're planting with the root crown at the soil level. And if that soil is often as wet as in the picture, you need to plant in a mound to get it dried out a lot more. Prunus species and malus species, apples and peaches, prunes, plums, things like that, really suffer when they have wet feet. So make sure that it stays dry enough and just consistently moist. You need to plant in a mound to get it dried out more. And also, you probably need a good 4-inch minimum depth layer of wood chips to help moderate your soil moisture levels. It's actually going to help dry them out in the wet times and keep it moist in the dry times. And that is going to help the tree fight off bacterial diseases, because you're going to have a more fungally dominant system right there, and the fungi will help fight off bacteria. Also, you don't want grasses competing with the tree right at the root zone and trunk. That's two things that will really cause it to suffer and, you know, set it back. So, thanks for the great questions, and remember, I am planning a trip to visit family in North Dakota in August. That trip is still tentatively on, so if you're in the middle states or even as far north as my crazy parents, shoot me an email if you want to get included on a consulting tour next month. That is Nick, N-I-C-K, at homegrownliberty.com with consulting in the subject line. Hope that helps. I'm Nick Ferguson with Homegrown Liberty, traveling the USA helping homesteaders like you design robust systems to feed your families. Do good things.
So, and Nick might be right about this. I'm going to say, Nick and I agree this tree's toast. The odds that you're going to save this tree are very low at this point. But I don't think it's canker. It could be. But when I looked at it, because I've seen this orange marmalade shit before, and when I've done deeper into specifically peaches, I've always been able to then figure out that what we're dealing with is a peach tree borer, specifically the larval stage of the peach tree borer moth. And if you want to know what they look like, just go to like Google or Brave Search or something like that, put in peach tree borer, and then click on images, and you'll find images of the tree, the damage to the tree, and you'll also find images of the adult moth. And if you see these things around, they're really obvious, because they, just like squash vine borers look sort of like a wasp, these things to me look even more like a big black and orange wasp, but they don't sting. They're not really a wasp. They just mimic one, and that's probably why they don't have a lot of predators, because wasps sting when things try to eat them, and things learn that really quick. Either way, it's probably dead. And I would maybe, if you're the person that wrote in, do like a post-mortem and go ahead and check inside the tree and see which one it was, because that the reason it's even important, because like Nick said, the tree is toast. This tree is toast. It really, I'm sorry, but it is. It's toast. But knowing which one you're dealing with may help you with preventative measures for other trees. Just saying. But that's what I think it is. All right, let's move on to my discussion today. I want to talk about the mental illness of the left. Now, I'm not talking about liberals. I'm not talking about the fact that I think taxes suck, and the lower your taxes, the better your economy would be. And if you think taxes that are higher are good, you're clueless from an economic standpoint. That's an education issue, right? And that's an opinion issue. And even though you're going to have a hard time convincing me, I'll sit down and have a rational debate with someone that wants to try to make the case that if we tax the rich or raise the tax rates, that somehow everything will be better. Okay, this isn't universal health care. I think universal health care is a terrible idea. I think the idea that a person can receive very expensive medical care for absolute no consideration whatsoever because they're poor and it can just become a drain on it is bad. But I'll have that debate, and a person on the other side of it can be rational and make salient points. And we will both agree that there are flaws, in if they're a rational person, in each other's views. I will agree that that does mean that people may not receive care that who should, and I'm not quite sure exactly how we figure that out, but blanket universal health care, where someone like me is paying 15 grand, and like it would be worse, by the way, under universal health care. I'm paying like 15 grand a year for my insurance, my wife's insurance, and then the things insurance don't cover. And I'm doing that because we have this quasi-universal healthcare system where we have Obamacare on the other end of it, so people that have lower incomes are paying almost nothing. You know, they're paying $29 a month for, like, a family of three. And don't say they're not, because I've seen it. Okay? In fact, the Obamacare website will advertise that you could qualify for it that low. And I do not think that makes sense, but that is not what I'm talking, just to be clear, and nothing like that. Here's some of the things that I would put under this category, that these people have been, through propaganda, mentally damaged. And Trump will come into this a bit, but it's not really about Trump. Trump just is a huge trigger right now, and to ignore it would be disingenuous. Trump will never leave office, and he's going to be a dictator. well, Trump left off, and he had January 6th. And see, now you've lost your mind, okay? And so there was a demonstration that turned into a riot that Trump had nothing to do with the riot, other than it was he was the catalyst for it, but he didn't tell anybody to do it. But even if he did, he still left office. He wasn't a dick. This man's already been in office. You're saying he's going to do a thing that he's not going to do, or because the Supreme Court said 250 years of standing law is still standing law, all of a sudden the president's a king that can order SEAL Team 6 to kill his enemies. This is you have to be mentally ill to believe that. If you don't vote for one side, I don't care what side it is, if you don't vote for one side in an election, it's the end of democracy. That statement is the end of democracy. And I'm not even going to get into democracy v. republic. And yes, the United States is a constitutional republic in the form of a representative democracy. I get that. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm saying in any election, if you don't vote for our side, it's the end of democracy. This requires mental illness. It makes sense to surgically alter children as to their sex. Children. We're talking 6 years old, 7 year old, 8 year old, 13 year old kids, either with surgery or hormones, altering them permanently for life. You have to be mentally ill to think that that's okay. Ocean levels are rising. They're not. The oceans haven't risen jack shit. I can take pictures of a location, one from 1925 and one from today, and the water's at the same place. I had young, concerned, otherwise intelligent people 10 years ago in California at Permaculture Voices point at water in a harbor that was 12 feet down from where we were standing, telling me in a decade that water would be where we were standing. And they believed it. If you gave them a polygraph, this is a mental illness. There is no place, you can't go to the most extreme examples of IPCC and get evidence that supports that, or even claims that that's good, but they believe it. The fact that and people will point to something like beach erosion and say it's rising sea levels. We can measure where the frickin' sea level is. It hasn't changed in 100 years. It's fluctuated a little bit up and down, but it hasn't changed in the overall macro. It's not true, and if you believe something that's easy to confirm isn't true, right? This isn't believing it will happen. This is believing it did happen. It didn't happen. You have to be mentally ill to not believe a thing when the facts are readily available to you. To believe that we can end the use of oil in the next 50 years. It's not possible. It's not, and it requires a denial of reality. I'm going to say you don't have to be as mentally ill as to believe this as you do everything, but you have to be willfully ignorant at least. And most people that believe that can happen are mentally ill on these other issues. Here's why. We can't predict, I mean, we physically, let me say this very clearly, we do not have, if we went all in, right, if it became a moonshot for every government in the world, we cannot produce enough copper along with rare earth elements to build the system in that amount of time. It cannot be done. It cannot be done. One more time. It is impossible to go net zero at our current current capability of extraction and production would take 2,400 years. Fact check that shit if you don't believe me. You might have to dig. I know I did. But you'll find out that it's true. We can't do it. We don't have the capability. We don't have the material. We don't have the resources or the ability to extract the resources fast enough. And you don't even have a clue about the ungodly amount of environmental damage you would be doing to do it. How many strip mines will it take to get the cadmium and the nickel and all the other rare earths that we need to make that many batteries that are capable of running systems like that? And if we don't get to the point where we can easily, reliably, and economically recycle them, you can say they're recyclable, but we all know what happens. They end up in landfills. It's an environmental catastrophe. You have to be mentally ill. Because if you want to know the truth, you can. This is not an opinion. Censorship is good and canceling old TV shows is necessary. You have to be mentally ill to think that it is necessary to cancel reruns of the fucking Dukes of Hazzard in, what was it, 2016 or 2018, whenever they did that shit? Like, what kind of person is so mentally fucked up that they're sitting there going, yeah, we got to make sure that, like, USA Network isn't running reruns of the Dukes of Hazzard at 11:30 on Wednesday night. You can't be mentally sane and think that's necessary. To be upset over a song like Baby It's Cold Outside and think it's a rape song when it was developed and produced and presented by a married couple at dinner parties in the 50s and 60s, and it's from a fucking movie about a tropical island in the middle of summer, and the whole damn thing was a joke about it being cold outside, and it was just like a flirtatious gimmick thing. You have to be mentally ill to think you need to do that. Censorship is good. I just saw a piece from the New York fucking Times saying that the First Amendment was in the way of progress. You have a newspaper actively campaigning against that amendment, which gives them the ability to be protected in their own free speech. To think that we need to censor people because we don't like what they say. You have to have a mental illness. Especially at the level that they're willing to do it, like the way they did it during COVID. You can be morbidly obese and be healthy. To believe that requires mental illness. I'm sorry. I'm not talking about somebody with a bit of a gut. I'm not talking about somebody that's an endomorph instead of an ectomorph, so they're always going to look a little heavier than someone else. I'm talking about people that are so obese that they have to lift up flabs and scrub under there or they grow a fungus. Okay, you're not healthy, and if you think you can, and if you ask so many young people today, and the people that are most affected by this are about 16 to 36, and they have had a number done on them. Can a person that's 400 pounds be healthy? A woman that's 5'4", can she be 400 pounds and healthy? They'll look you straight in the eye, tell you yes, and they will pass an exam, a polygraph. Okay, that's a mental illness. You have to be mentally ill to convince yourself that something that is clearly untrue is true. If you believe that you can stick a banana in the ground and grow a spaceship, and you really believe it, you're mentally ill. You're mentally ill. It's the same thing. Men can become women and women become men. This is not a rational thought. If you would have asked the average person this question in the year 2000, which is only 24 years ago, many of you were alive and can remember it well, they would have looked at you like you had a freaking alien crawling out of your ear. You might have gotten 1%, if you were lucky, 24 years ago, to answer that question with a yes. Today, I bet you more than half of the people you ask will give you a yes answer to this. This is not just mental illness. This is mass psychosis. This is mass psychosis. Imagine if you said, you went out on the street and you said to people, can a person, just by thinking about it, turn into a panda bear? And they didn't mean a furry that pretended to be one. I mean legitimately, like, morph into a panda bear. And more than half the people said yes and meant it. You'd say, God, are we screwed? This is the same thing. You cannot become a woman because you chose to in your head. If you were born with a dick and balls, you're a dude. To believe otherwise is a mental illness. Trump is going to repeal amendments like the 19th Amendment that gave women the right to vote. Presidents can't do that. You have to be mentally ill. You're so fucked up in the head that you got TDS, Trump Derangement Syndrome, that you'll believe anything if Trump's going to be the one to do it. No president can just do that. No president, like, this is, but what happened? This is what I'm saying. I know when we talk like this, it's really easy to just say, screw those people. No, it's not. Like, if you have somebody that really thinks they can fly, and they're standing on the top of a 10-story building telling you they can fly, and they're going to jump off, you try to talk them the hell down, at least hold them there long enough that maybe they can inflate a bag under there, and maybe they won't die. Maybe. Because just because it works on TV doesn't mean it works. But it's all you got, so that's what you would do. You don't say, go ahead and jump. I mean, if it's somebody freaked out because they're a pedophile and you chased them up there with a gun and they threaten to jump, they're like, jump before I shoot you, bitch. I'm talking about somebody that, like, didn't hurt anybody and just really thinks they can. You say, no, you can't fly. You are not a bird. We just have to start approaching these people. And I don't know how to do it because it's such a huge level of mass psychosis. But people have been scared into a place that makes it a very dangerous time in history. The propaganda machine and what has been done to people is unbelievable. Unbelievable. And you know what it leads to? It leads to things like the Holocaust. Do you think the German people were willing to let what happened happen because they were just that evil and mean and malevolent and hated people? Or do you think that they were whipped into a frenzy of fear and economic chaos so they would go along with anything, and once they got far enough into it and they got vested into the lie, they could not bring themselves to disbelieve the lie? If you really believed that in 10 years or 20 years the oceans would rise and kill a billion people, what would you do to stop it if you really believed it? If you really believe that the Orange Man is the second coming of Hitler, if you really believe, left unchecked, this man is going to round people up and kill 6 million people, if you really believe that, what would you do to stop it? Think as a sane person. If you believed what these insane people believe, what would you do to prevent it? And the answer is, you would do just about anything, including sacrificing your own life. That's where these people are mentally. They really believe this shit. I know when you listen to it, and there's the extreme examples and the TikTokers looking for attention that say the most ridiculous shit just to get engagement. I understand that. But no, the average person believes this. Get a camera, go into a city area, go into a college area, go to somewhere where you can find people that are, let's say, aged 18 to 20, 28, that 10-year demographic, and ask those, especially females, do you believe that a man can become a woman? And more than half will tell you yes. If you confine it to women at that age, I bet you right now 70% or more will say yes. This is mentally ill. I'm sorry, I'm not insulting anybody. I'm talking about a serious, serious problem we have. And usually I don't point to a problem without a solution. This problem is so big, I don't have a solution. All I think we can do is continue to speak the truth and hope that across time, as everything that they're told is going to happen doesn't happen, they'll begin to question it. And people do wake up every day. But as much as I think COVID woke us up, that was 2020, and 2020 really, that was the year that it reached. That's only 3 years ago. If you take the whole year, it's 2.5 really, because we ain't done with this one yet. And as much as I'd like to say it woke people up, and I think it did wake people up, for every person that was kind of asleep as to what your government and the corporations are really doing that was woken up, I think two went into mental illness. The what's been done is so frightening. It's why I worry about the future for my grandchildren, for God's sakes. And I don't know what to do about it. Electing the Orange Man won't fix that. Replacing Biden with somebody that's not completely incompetent won't do that. The next election cycle won't do that. We're not going to win this or fix this or even make it better by who we elect. We're going to have come up with a different way to speak to these people, to reach these people. And I don't know what will do it. When I listen to 18, 20-year-old women who should be most on the side of protecting unborn life, say that a baby that's 8 months developed is nothing but a clump of cells. Now, I don't talk about the abortion issue much because there's no winning in this issue no matter what side you take. And I take the middle, and that really is a non-winning position. And please don't email me about it and try to change my mind, because you're not gonna. I'm a fully informed man, 52 years old. I have made my decision about this, and I'm not trying to convince you that you're wrong. I'm just telling you I know where I sit on this. But I do know this, that way more than half the people in this country, if you take everybody at all age, would tell you, no, it's not okay to abort a fetus at 8 months of age. And then they'll throw around numbers like 16 weeks, 22 weeks, and people talk about that. Oh, my God, you're going to take away reproductive rights. 16 weeks is 4 fucking months. Okay? I think the average person, if they looked at what a child looked like developing in the womb, there's a point at which, if you had even the crazy people, if you made them look at high-resolution images, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks, there is some place that the 75% or more would go, that stop right there. That's it. I don't know. I don't know if I'm wrong. I don't know if it should be earlier, but that is a point where we can't go past. That's sanctity of life at this point. but they won't even look at it. So I don't know how you reach a person that won't even consider what you have to say. That's convinced that you, by not, and that's the thing, this is how you know they're mentally ill. If you disagree with them 1%, you're evil. You're Trump. You're Hitler. You're literally Hitler. And so I'm sorry to drop this on you last new show of the week without a solution to it. But I want to know what you guys think. How do we reach people that believe these things in the absence of all logic? How do you reach a person that thinks it makes sense to hire someone to oversee the disposal of our nuclear waste who has no experience with nuclear or any kind of high-level government position, who dresses in latex and has sex with men dressed as dogs and steals luggage from airports to get dresses? And you knew that when you hired him, and you don't have a problem with it. I'm sorry, but I'm not sorry. You're mentally ill if you're okay with that. Do I have a problem with that guy other than the theft of property living that way? No. But I don't want him in charge of our nuclear fucking waste when he doesn't know the three parts of an atom. I'm getting into quantum there, thinking quarks and shit. But like, you know, your proton, neutron, electron. Dude probably can't explain to you the basic assembly of an atom. And he's in charge of our nuclear waste. Are you fucking kidding me? Because he's diverse? Saying that white people are bad, there's one for you I didn't even put in my list, right? Saying white people are evil and you're white. I'm telling you, I have this in my own family. I have nieces and nephews that went through phases where I won't date a white person and they're white because they went to university. I don't know. I think the only solution we really have long term is to get them the hell out of the hellhole that is our education system. But what do you think? Let me know. I'm sorry I went on so long. I didn't plan on that. But this is, let's be clear, I think the first step to recovery is admitting the problem. The problem is not that the right or the anarchists or the libertarians or anybody else or even the sane left has not done a good enough job with messaging. It is not that we need to evolve our position to be closer to theirs or better understand them. This is mental illness. And reinforcing mental illness is never a good idea. You know, it was really hard for me to get ChatGPT even to admit that, as long as I was talking about gender dysphoria. But when I phrased it generically, is it ever a good idea to reinforce a mental illness, it came up with a very quick, logical answer. No! You don't reinforce mental illnesses, you treat them. How do we treat this mass psychosis that's infecting more than 50% of the people in this country? I don't have an answer. I'd like to hear yours. I think we went on long enough today, so I will wrap up there. One quick thing here at the end that I will tell you is I do have a new item of the day today that I think you might like. It's made by Vavor. It's a stair-climbing cart or stair-climbing dolly or a stair-climbing hand truck. You decide what works for you. It's pretty badass. It's on sale. As long as you have an account with Vavor right now for like $113 or something like that. Plus, you can get 5% off. I have a video of how it works in action where I'm actually using it. I think every prepper should own a dolly. We always have to move stuff around sooner or later. And there's certain things that it's much better to have a dolly than a wheelbarrow or a cart or something like that. And I would check this thing out. I'll let it go at that today since I went so long with my anchor segment. I wish you guys the best. Have a great weekend. Tomorrow we'll have a cool Friday flashback. Again, sorry to get on the soapbox there, but this is actually something I'm sharing with you. Not so much, like most of the stuff I share with you is to keep you informed or to teach you something. I shared all that with you because I'm hoping you share my concern. And I'm hoping as a community we can begin to figure out some things we can do to reach these people because I'm really not mocking them. I'm really sincere. When people believe things this out of balance, they have a real serious mental illness. And I don't know if there's ever been a time in history where this many people were this mentally ill at the same time. And when we've had mass psychosis in the past, it's run the gamut of things that were relatively contained, like the Salem witch trials, all the way to things like the Holocaust. Take care, guys. I'll catch you on Monday with another new episode. Just
run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.